It's Who Knew That Could Happen?
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Today on the show, we hear from Andrew Smith. Later, Brian Lynn tells us about a hopeful development in medicine for people in need of new hearts. Reporter Brian will then join me in the studio for a chat about the story. And we will close the show with another part of our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's Andrew Smith.
When Asmita Spoods Bhadari was a young girl in Nepal, she dreamed of being in the military. Now her dream has come true. But instead of serving in Nepal's military, she recently joined the U.S. Army Reserves. Bhadari, who heads to basic training in August, is just the latest in a growing number of legal migrants entering the U.S. military. In the U.S., military service is not required, and it has been difficult for the military to get enough people to volunteer. As a result, the Army and Air Force have reached out to immigrants, offering a pathway to citizenship for those who join. The military is using social media and trying to connect to more people, particularly in inner cities. One important way they do this is by using recruiters with similar backgrounds to the immigrants. It is one thing to hear about the military from locals here, but it is something else when it's from your fellow brother, from the country you're from, said Bhadari. She was contacted by Army Staff Sergeant Khaldun Lama, who is also from Nepal. Both the Army and the Air Force say they will not meet their recruiting goals this year, and the Navy also expects to fall short. Defense leaders say young people are more interested in high-paying and less risky jobs. And only about 20% of the people who could join the military meet the physical and mental requirements. The military says it faces two big challenges. One is finding ways to reach some immigrant populations. The other is helping them with the complex process to join the service. The Air Force effort began this year. The first group of 14 finished basic training and became new U.S. citizens in April. They included immigrants from Cameroon, Jamaica, Kenya, the Philippines, Russia, and South Africa. As of mid-May, there were about 100 in basic training who had begun the citizenship process and about 40 who had finished it. Air Force Major General Ed Thomas is head of the service's recruiting command. He said the Air Force does extra work to make sure the immigrants are not a security risk. He added that in many cases, immigrants are not put into jobs that require top secret work. Under the new Air Force program, immigrants can become citizens as soon as they finish their 7 weeks of basic training. In the Army, close to 2,900 immigrants joined during the first half of this budget year, compared with about 2,200 during the same period last year. The largest numbers are from Jamaica, with 384, followed by Mexico, the Philippines, and Haiti. Others are from Nepal, Nigeria, Ghana, Cameroon, Colombia, and the Dominican Republic. Bidari, from Nepal, arrived in the U.S. in 2016 to attend college. She said becoming a U.S. citizen will make it easier for her to travel and bring her parents to the U.S. to visit. She said she joined the military for 6 years and hopes that her future citizenship will help her become an officer. As a little girl, looking at the soldiers, I always had admiration for them, said Bidari, talking about British troops in Nepal. She also talked about how she felt the moment she joined the U.S. military. I don't think I have words to really explain how I was feeling. When they said, "Welcome, future soldier," I was like, "Oh my goodness, this is happening." I'm Andrew Smith.
Researchers say a new method for heart transplants could increase the number of available organs and save more lives. Currently, most transplanted hearts come from donors who have been declared brain dead. This means the person no longer has signs of brain function after suffering a serious injury. In a brain death, machines can keep the body breathing and can provide oxygen to organs until they can be recovered and put on ice. But the new method would take hearts from medical cases known as circulatory deaths. These cases are also known as donation after circulatory death, or DCD. Circulatory deaths happen when a person has a non-survivable brain injury but still has some brain function. In these cases, family members can decide to withdraw all life support measures. This means organs go without oxygen for a time before they can be recovered. Currently, kidneys and some other organs are taken from people suffering circulatory deaths. But doctors have resisted using hearts because of possible organ damage from a lack of oxygen. A new study suggests that hearts might also be recoverable from cases of circulatory deaths. Researchers at North Carolina's Duke University School of Medicine led the study, which was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The researchers said using hearts from circulatory deaths could possibly give thousands more patients a chance at a life-saving transplant. And it could increase the number of donor hearts by 30%. Honestly, if we could snap our fingers and just get people to use this, I think it probably would go up even more than that, transplant doctor Jacob Schroeder told the Associated Press. This really should be standard of care, he said. With the new method, doctors can remove hearts in circulatory deaths and put them in a machine that reanimates them. This process pumps blood and nutrients through the heart as they are being transported. The organs can also be tested to make sure they are effectively functioning before they are transplanted. The study involved multiple hospitals around the country, as well as 180 transplant patients. Half the patients received DCD hearts, and half were given hearts from brain-dead donors that were transported on ice. Survival rates 6 months later were about the same, 94% for recipients of cardiac death donations and 90% for those who got the usual hearts, the researchers reported. The findings are exciting and show the possibility to increase fairness and equity in heart transplantation, said Dr. Nancy Schweitzer. She is a heart transplant specialist at Washington University in St. Louis. Schweitzer, who was not part of the study, said she thinks the new method will permit more people with heart failure to receive life-saving treatment. In the U.S. last year, 4,111 heart transplants were performed. While this was a record number, it is not nearly enough to meet the need. Hundreds of thousands of people suffer from advanced heart failure, but many are never offered a transplant. Still others die waiting for one. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure thing, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Your report talked about a new method for heart transplants that doctors say could greatly increase the number of available organs and save more lives. Why don't we explore some words used in the report that might be new to our listeners?
Okay, let's do it. First up, let's look at the term function. So, a very simple definition of the word, as it is used in the report, would be what something does or how it operates. In this case, we're talking about brain function or heart function. So, describing what operations those two organs perform, and function can also be used as a verb with the same meaning.
Okay. How about the expression, snap our fingers, which appears in the report?
Yes, that's a good one, Katie. The phrase, snap your fingers, literally means to press your thumb and finger together in a way that can make a snapping sound, kind of like this. And this action or gesture can be used for different purposes. But the expression is used in the report to describe something that can be completed very easily and with little effort. So, for example, an English speaker might say, I snapped my fingers and my project was finished. This phrase probably means the person did not actually snap their fingers, but the project was not difficult to complete and took very little effort.
I can do it too. Thank you for joining me to discuss your report and for the new vocabulary.
You're welcome. Thank you, Katie.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of Bill Clinton, America's 42nd president. He led the United States for 8 years from January of 1993 to January of 2001. Our story begins in 1991. In February of that year, American-led forces won Operation Desert Storm to end Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein considered Kuwait a province of Iraq. He had invaded the oil-rich country in August 1990. Coalition airstrikes began 4 months later in January against Iraqi targets. The ground war took place in February and lasted just 4 days. The American-led victory in the Gulf War added to the popularity of President George H.W. Bush. 1991 was also the last year for the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The collapse of the Soviet Union brought an end to more than 40 years of Cold War tensions and fears of nuclear war. In the United States, attention was turning to the 1992 presidential election. Many political observers believed President Bush would easily win a second term. But the economy was not doing much to help his chances. The United States went through a serious recession that lasted 8 months, from July 1990 to March 1991. Unemployment rose to the highest level in years. At the same time, the federal government was deeply in debt after years of borrowing. Bush was a Republican. Democrats saw his falling popularity as a good opportunity to retake the White House. They placed their hopes on William Jefferson Clinton. At the time, he was the young governor of the southern state of Arkansas. He was gaining national attention by talking about issues like education. Bill Clinton was born on August 19, 1946, in the small town of Hope, Arkansas. His name at birth was William Jefferson Blythe. His father, also named William Jefferson Blythe, was a traveling salesman. He died in a car accident 3 months before his son was born. At the age of two, the boy was sent to live with his grandparents while his mother, Virginia Blythe, studied to become a nurse. She married a man named Roger Clinton when her son was four. The family moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. When he was 15, William Jefferson Blythe legally changed his name to William Jefferson Clinton. His stepfather drank too much and was sometimes abusive to him, his mother, and his stepbrother, Roger Jr. But Bill Clinton did well in school. He also developed a strong early interest in politics and ran for student offices in high school. In 1963, while still in high school, Bill Clinton went to Washington as a delegate to a Boys Nation program for young leaders. There, he got to meet President John F. Kennedy. Years later, Richard Stratton, who was president of Boys Nation in 1963, remembered that meeting.
It was a beautiful, bright summer day. It was July 24, 1963. And we were all assembled in the Rose Garden at the White House as a group, waiting for the president to come out. We all sat there, riveted in attention.
We want to welcome you to the White House. particularly because this belongs to all of you and because it's so intimately connected with the best in American history.
I was about the third or fourth person in. And he started here, and I sort of muscled my way up and made sure I got to shake hands with the president. He was quite generous. He went down the line and shook hands with a pretty good number of us who were there that day. It had a very profound impact on me. I think that, you know, it's something that I carried with me always. And I was very fortunate that someone took a picture of it and gave it to me, so I was always able to remember it.
Right after that frame, the famous frame of him shaking hands with JFK, there's another picture from the same film showing President Kennedy shaking hands with Jeff Keyes, another one of our boys, him from Florida, and Bill Clinton looking down at his hand with this wonderful look like I'll never wash it again.
Bill Clinton went on to study at Georgetown University in Washington. He graduated in 1968 and won a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Oxford University in England. He spent 2 years there before entering Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. There, he met another law student, Hillary Rodham. She was from just outside Chicago, and she shared his deep interest in politics and public service. They both graduated in 1973. Bill Clinton returned to Arkansas. Hillary Rodham went on to become a lawyer involved in the congressional investigation of the Watergate scandal. That case led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon in 1974. That same year, Bill Clinton, a Democrat, ran for Congress in Arkansas. He lost the close race to a popular Republican. A year later, he and Hillary Rodham married. And a year after that, in 1976, Arkansas voters elected him Attorney General, the state's top law enforcement officer. In 1978, Bill Clinton ran for governor and easily won. He became, at the age of 32, the state's youngest governor ever. While Bill Clinton was governor, the federal government operated a detention center in Arkansas for Cuban refugees. The refugees rioted. That rioting hurt Bill Clinton politically when he ran for re-election. His opponent argued that he should have done more to get the government to hold the Cubans someplace else. Also, Clinton had supported unpopular new taxes. In 1980, Bill Clinton was defeated in his campaign for a second term as governor of Arkansas. But he regained the office in the next election 2 years later. That was before the term of office was increased from 2 years to 4 years. Clinton went on to serve as governor of Arkansas until 1992. While he was governor, education in the state improved. More students finished high school, and more went on to college. The state increased requirements for teachers and also increased their pay. Governor Clinton also expanded early learning programs for children from poor families. While governor, Bill Clinton also became active in Democratic Party leadership at the national level.
Make no mistake, this election is about change. Change in our party, change in our leadership, change in our nation. And that is why today I proudly announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America.
In 1991, Bill Clinton announced that he would run for the Democratic nomination for president. His main opponents were Paul Tsongas and Jerry Brown. Tsongas was a former senator from Massachusetts. Brown had been governor of California. Paul Tsongas later withdrew, and Bill Clinton easily defeated Jerry Brown for the nomination. Democrats held their national nominating convention in New York City in July 1992.
And so, in the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes, raise the kids, and play by the rules, in the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Bill Clinton chose Senator Al Gore of Tennessee as his running mate for vice president. The Republicans nominated President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle for a second term. Another candidate in the 1992 presidential election was a Texas businessman named Ross Perot. He competed as an independent, a so-called third-party candidate. His choice for vice president was James Stockdale, a former high-level Navy officer and pilot. He had been shot down and held as a prisoner of North Vietnam for 7 years. During the campaign, Ross Perot argued that neither of the major candidates was taking the national debt seriously enough. He also warned of the loss of American jobs.
To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay $1 an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Bill Clinton criticized President Bush for not doing more about the economy and unemployment. Bush pointed out that the Democrats controlled Congress, and he said the Democrats had defeated most of his proposals. The president also talked about his foreign policy successes, and most famously, he promised not to raise taxes.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say, read my lips. No new taxes.
But raise taxes he did, and many Americans remembered that on Election Day. Bill Clinton and Al Gore won the 1992 election. They received about 45 million votes, or 6 million more than President Bush and Vice President Quayle. Ross Perot and James Stockdale received close to 20 million, or 19% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton became America's 42nd president on January 20th, 1993. At the age of 46, he was the third youngest person ever elected president. At his inauguration, the new president said there was no longer a division between foreign and domestic issues.
The world economy, the world environment, the world AIDS crisis, the world arms race, they affect us all. Today, as an old order passes, the new world is more free but less stable. Communism's collapse has called forth old animosities and new dangers. Clearly, America must continue to lead the world we did so much to make.
But even as he took office, critics were questioning Clinton's character. There had been accusations during the campaign about relationships with other women in Arkansas. And there were questions about an investment that he and Hillary Clinton had made in a land development project back in 1978.
That's all the time we have for today's program. But we'll be back tomorrow. with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.